So welcome to the Fakeologist Radio Show. David Crow of the Infectious Myth now joins us. I've been a big fan of David Crow and the Infectious Myth. I am one of his Patreons, and you should be too. He has a weekly show that he discusses all the different controversial health aspects in the world. For instance, AIDS. He's talked about the AIDS virus. And, of course, now his perspective is more relevant than ever because he talks about the coronavirus, which, of course, to me is one of the biggest psychological operation hoaxes of our time. So I thought I should get David Crow on as soon as possible because there's no one in Canada, at least, that talks as well as he does about what I think is one of the bigger fakes in the world, which is the whole world of virology, which, of course, the whole world's ignorance is being taken advantage of right now. And we are undergoing probably the most dramatic change in the history of the world, at least our world at this time that we know of. And that's why I wanted to bring on David Crow. So we have about an hour. So I'm going to say hello to David Crow. Hello, David.
Hello, and thanks for inviting me.
Now, if anyone follows David Crow and the Infectious Myth, he made a very dramatic and very upsetting announcement to all his fans, including myself, and that is that, well, why don't you tell us the announcement that you made on your last show?
Rectal tumor that's metastasized to my liver. And the mainstream doctors have basically written me off. Okay. So I'm exploring alternatives, but it's definitely debilitating. So anyway, I'm hoping that I can turn it around. But I have to face the reality of my own mortality.
So now we have the best spokesman that we've heard from in the alternative media community, and now you are ill with what stage cancer is it?
Well, I've got two large metastasized tumors on my liver, and I've got edema, which is caused by the malfunctioning liver. But, you know, it's hard to say how fast things are progressing inside me.
Yeah.
I'm starting with a naturopath, hopefully this week.
So they haven't given you a stage that you're at? You know, we hear the
stages. Well, it's technically stage four, but as mm-hmm. one cancer scientist pointed out, if you've got a tumor in two places, that's stage four automatically. So it doesn't mm-hmm. really mean anything. And people have told me to have hope that they've seen worse cases, but I'm also seeing a rapid decline in my energy mm-hmm. levels and in my body weight. If you discount the weight that I've gained from edema of just water.
Well, I'm very sorry to hear it, mainly because you're such a bright light in the alternative media community, and you're one of the only people that speak eloquently on controversial health topics, and we need alternative voices. So this is the wrong time for someone to be getting sick, so I really feel badly for you, of course, from a human to human level. And now we need you in the alternative army more than ever. So this is really depressing.
Left to do. And, you know, if I do get past this, I'm going to be a lot more focused on, you know, finishing a book that was going nowhere. And, you know, focusing on the accomplishments I want. You know, if I could come back and get another 20 years, I would not waste them.
Well, I think when you get towards the midpoint in life, that's when you start realizing the only thing you have left is time, and you don't want to waste it. And they've always mm-hmm. said that youth is wasted on the young or something like that, where you don't realize that you have a limited amount of time, you are very mortal, and as you get towards the end of the race, it becomes more and more obvious that you're going to run out of time no matter what you're doing. So try not to waste too much time. So I think the work you do is great, and you give a lot of voice to people that don't have a voice and are just not in the mainstream. So I've valued all your work, so at least you've got it all down in recordings forever, so people can still review it. It's still relevant.
Yeah, yeah. And on my website, theinfectiousmyth.com, there's a tremendous amount on coronavirus. I haven't really been able to update it the last few weeks, but you know, I'm hoping that I start to gain a bit more energy and that I can update some of my documents and maybe write one or two more.
And we're definitely going to talk about coronavirus hoax tonight. Now, I'm a fakeologist, which means I study media fakery. We've talked about it before. So my idea is that almost every major media event that's promoted around the world is most likely fake or a psychological operation or both. And when this came along, it just came very gradually. And I thought it might be a minor blip in the old media fakery world. Little did I know that it was going to become just a massive revolution when it comes to the way we do things. And the actual virus and the story of viruses is becoming rapidly fading into the distance, because once they get past the one central lie, they can just work on all the other things that they really want to accomplish with the lie. So I just think the whole idea about viruses and the coronavirus is just fading rapidly into the background. So people like me that want to basically explore the idea that viruses themselves are a hoax, in the sense that they're being used, just as your website says, as infectious myths to create this panic and this just whole new society. I think if we could blow apart the central lie that viruses, in this particular case, are not infectious, as in transmittable in this exponential way that the models that they're working with all purport, then we could blow the whole thing apart. So what do you say to that?
People said that they were surprised at how quickly it came up to speed on it. But as soon as I heard about it, it was a coronavirus. SARS, you know, it's claimed to be a coronavirus. SARS was claimed to be a coronavirus. I got out my book chapter on SARS, which is like 90% complete. I did a bunch of work on it and reviewed it. And, you know, in that I learned, or sort of relearned, reminded myself that there was no proof that the SARS virus existed. There was lots of proof it really wasn't infectious. And there were lots of iatrogenic or doctor-caused causes for death, such as intubation, the antiviral drug ribavirin, and high-dose corticosteroids. Now, some things have changed. There's still lots of evidence that the new coronavirus is not infectious. For example, a couple in Illinois, after some time after the wife came back from Wuhan, they both went to emergency and tested positive. They found 350 or so contacts, the CDC did. They followed them all up and they found zero positive, even those who'd had compatible symptoms. And of course, there are no symptoms for the new coronavirus disease, you know, cough, fever, things that are associated with 1,000 different causes, not necessarily even infectious causes. Mm-hmm. So that was infectivity. And then when it came to treatments, the intubation was as disastrous as it was during SARS. In New York, amongst people 65 and older, they found a 97% death rate amongst those intubated, and it was 76% amongst people who were younger. Mm-hmm. Another iatrogenic, well, it's not really an iatrogenic cause, but it sort of helped with the iatrogenic killing, was the fact that these people, like in Italy, the average age was 80, something like 60% had three or more pre-existing health conditions. So you had very old, frail people who were then hit with antiviral drugs, sometimes corticosteroids, sometimes, you know, even chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine, mm-hmm. you know, which are not innocuous drugs. Mm-hmm.
They're toxic.
So there was that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what have I got? So there's the lack of infectivity. There's the iatrogenic causes. And then I think that the reason why old people were dying is there's two more reasons. One is that they were completely isolated. So take away the visitors. The visitors not only help look after them, but they also monitor the treatment in the in the facility. Workers are underpaid. Some are quarantined. Some quit. And so it leaves the place really understaffed. And that results in abuse, neglect, unsanitary procedures because people just don't have time to do things right. And I think, you know, the fact that these patients were lying in bed staring at the ceiling for 23 hours of the day.
Very depressing.
It will kill people. Yep. I read a German article, you know, which talked about the general situation, but they had this anecdote of this granddaughter who, you know, in February, they decided to put her grandmother in a nursing home. And at first they said she was doing well. She was having visitors. She was adjusting to the place and things seemed to be good, but then they were cut off from contact. She was deaf. They couldn't make phone calls. So they wrote her postcards, but she just went downhill and died. And so I think that's a big problem. Another thing that's come out is that in several countries like Spain, they didn't want these nursing home patients in hospitals. So the hospitals resisted taking them. And you know, some of them needed maybe treatment for, say, an infected wound or, you know, some relatively minor thing. They needed to go to the hospital. The hospital wouldn't take them. So the Spanish Society for, what do they call it, palliative care, said that if you can't take a patient to ICU, you start to sedate them. And, of course, if they're sick, I mean, let's say they have an infected wound. Well, it's going to get worse. So the pain's going to increase, so you increase the sedation. And at some point, the patient doesn't wake up. You increase the amount of sedation and you increase the potency of the drugs you're giving. So all of this, like we don't need a virus to explain why people are dying. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. I started by saying the virus does not exist and that the science does not support the existence of a virus. RNA is not proof of the existence of a virus unless you purified the virus.
Well, one of the YouTubers I follow, Vernon Coleman, has said, first, he's a doctor, retired, he says, in the UK, and he started off by just being very suspicious of the whole event, which I call it. It's an event, the worldwide event, similar to Event 201 that was put on by the Johns Hopkins and other agencies like the WHO, Bill Gates' WHO. And he thinks that, now he thinks for sure it's a hoax. He calls it the coronavirus hoax, which is a label I gave to it at least back in March as a just sort of a easy to say, roll off your tongue alternative to what they're calling it. And he thinks it's just in general a plot to get rid of old people. Now, I don't think there's a deliberate genocide going on, although he makes an argument for it. Just
well,
for various reasons.
I mean, it's what's happening. I mean, a lot
it
of
is what's happening. Okay,
iatrogenic disasters are not caused by malice. They're caused because, you know, a particular disease model is embedded in the minds of the doctors, and they, you know, they just follow along on standard practice or state of the art practice, and it kills their patients. I think in this case, there is also a little bit of a monetary incentive because, you know, the amount of money, you get money for COVID patients.
Right.
And we could get into how broken the statistics are. And you get more money if you intubate them.
Right.
So all of this stuff, like I remember Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, standing up and saying, you know, we need 25,000 ventilators in New York State in order to intubate people. And they probably needed 25.
Right.
And so they wasted all this money on ventilators, and when they used them, they killed people.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think the doctors realized what was going to happen, but you take a, you know, an 80-year-old with three pre-existing health conditions and you put them on a ventilator, chances of them coming back are extremely low. And And, you know, they may have put much younger and healthier people on ventilators before for, you know, serious operations, but never had this incredible death rate. And the doctors eventually realized it and started to revolt. Mm-hmm. Like the doctors didn't want to be killing all their patients. It's sort of, you know, if it's 50% is one thing, but if it's 97% death rate, even the doctors notice that this is not working.
Well, just looking at the name of your website, The Infectious Myth. Now, why did you name it The Infectious Myth? My idea is that you named it that because, and I registered the website, you can't catch a virus. The whole idea of the germ theory versus the terrain theory, I think, is the central part of this entire lie that has been built and called the coronavirus hoax or COVID. Now, this do you believe that, can you catch a virus?
I don't believe viruses exist. I don't believe any viruses exist.
Okay.
And we shouldn't really go down the exosome rabbit hole. Exosomes are important because they are identical to viruses under an electron microscope. They're produced by the cell. So we know that what's called a virus under the electron microscope could easily be an exosome. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that there's any relationship between exosomes and this disorder. Right? Okay. There's no logical connection there. Okay. Exosomes are important because they say that just because you see a particle that's 100 nanometers in size and it's on the edge of a cell, that does not mean it's an infectious virus. It could mean it's a completely non-infectious exosome performing a normal function, or maybe it's reacting to, some stress on the cell and it's trying to remove toxins or something like that. I was quite resistant to accepting, I started with HIV and I accepted that HIV was not infectious and probably that HIV virus didn't exist. Mm-hmm. But then somebody told me, well, polio is the same thing. And I thought, no, I don't want to go there. Mm-hmm. But when I did go there, I realized that the environmental, explanations for polio, such as pesticides, made a lot more sense.
Me too.
There were mysteries about polio. For example, why does it have such a strong seasonality?
Right.
That about 90% of cases occur during the fruit harvest season.
Like, right. Exactly.
Why would that be? And I looked at West Nile virus, and that was like shockingly shoddy. And I also looked at mad cow disease based on the research of an organic beef farmer named Mark Purdy in the United Kingdom, who sadly passed away. And that's not supposed to be a virus, it's supposed to be a prion, but it doesn't really make that much difference. But again, you know, the environmental cause, which in England was an ill-considered pesticide program by the British government that did not occur anywhere in the world, anywhere else in the world, and nor did any big outbreak. Like in Canada, I think there's like two or three cows randomly spring up with mad cow disease every year. Mm-hmm. And it's not really acting like an infectious disease.
Right.
It's acting. And again, it could be that those cows have been poisoned by eating feed that's being contaminated. You know, somebody spills pesticides on the grain and doesn't bother, you know, doesn't want to waste the grain, so they feed it to the cows anyway, and one cow eats the stuff that's contaminated and becomes sick.
Right, exactly. You know,
it's a neurological disease. So there are just lots of, you know, every supposedly infectious disease I've looked at has turned out to be an infectious myth. Now, it is true that, bacteria and parasites and amoeba and things like that exist. Mm-hmm. I think in those cases, there may be no question that there's some involvement of these things.
And they're transmissible. We can pass them.
Yeah, and they're transmissible.
Okay.
But I think often the infectious part is overhyped. So for example, with tuberculosis, why is it that the doctors and nurses tend not to get sick, whereas, you know, the mine workers or other people do get sick? Could it be that their lungs are being damaged by mine dust or whatever segment they're in, or they're living in poverty and the air quality inside their shanty is terrible, and that's what's causing tuberculosis, plus they maybe have a really bad diet, which doesn't allow their body to fight things off. Mm-hmm. So it does fit as much with the terrain theory mm-hmm. as with the germ theory. You know, if the pathogen by itself cannot cause disease, then it is not the cause. It might be, you know, part of the cause. Because if your lungs are, take the lungs, if your lungs are damaged, something's going to come in there and start eating it, right? Like that's when you get infections in there, when you have dying tissue.
Or your own body taking care of it. Your own body takes care of damaged tissue, does it not? It cannot allow decaying tissue in its
right.
Health.
But if you're malnourished,
right,
and you're continuing to live in this environment, then you know I think comes a point where your body can't handle it. Right. Anthrax was similar. It emerged amongst sheep shearers. Well, the sheep shearers work in these, these warehouses full of sheep dust. And that's like little bits and pieces, mostly of wool fibers that are going to be incredibly damaging to your lungs.
Right.
And so some of them came down
with stuff. Yeah.
You know, like anthrax, the same kind of thing as tuberculosis, but a specifically different, cause.
Very good. Okay, so if we can communicate the idea to people that you can't catch a virus, do you not think that it completely neutralizes the whole coronavirus hoax, what we're going through right now?
Well, I find, you know, it's kind of like a lawyer makes an argument somewhat like this. Mm-hmm. You know, my client didn't murder John Smith. First of all, he wasn't there.
Yeah.
And if you don't believe that, he never touched the weapon. And if you don't believe that, he never fired the weapon. And if you don't believe that, he missed.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So they make this argument like, and that's a perfectly legitimate argument, right? Like you hope that your first argument is accepted. If it's not, then you go on and do more.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we can argue against coronavirus even if we accept that the virus exists. The RT-PCR test has a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed Stephen Buston, who's probably the world expert on quality control for RT-qPCR, which is reverse transcriptase quantitative PCR. I mean, the first thing you need to know about it is it's not quantitative. The second thing is that all the tests use a quantitative measure to distinguish between positive and negative on a test that's not quantitative. And the reason it's not quantitative is because the test is run for a particular number of cycles. First of all, every test uses pretty much a different number of cycles from about 30 through 45. And each cycle doubles the sensitivity. So you've got like multiple thousands of differences between the sensitivity of these tests. Say 37 cycles for one test run is not quantitatively the same number as 37 cycles for another test run. So you're not actually measuring positive and negative against the same quantitative standard. There is no way to use RT-qPCR as far as I can see.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't say that. So Buston described a method where you could theoretically make it more quantitative. And that would be that you run a known quantity of RNA in the sample in parallel with the RNA that you're looking for. And you sort of see how much of the standard RNA you get versus what you're looking for. And then you can adjust the quantitative amount. But given that every step is doubling the sensitivity, you're still not actually getting a very accurate quantitative result. So I did a paper on all the different problems with qT-PCR. Others are that they're all looking for different bits and pieces, about 1% of the full genome, that some look for just one piece and they're happy if you find it. Some look for two, and then if they look for two, some demand that you have both, and some say one or the other is fine. And some look for three, and most of those will allow any two out of three. So you have this strange situation where somebody is positive, supposedly. But they've got, you know, two bits and pieces, and somebody else has a different two bits and pieces. It's only an overlap of one. How can you say that somebody has the virus when there's a piece of it missing?
David, and then do you think anyone's, sorry to interrupt, because we only have an hour, do you think anyone is doing these tests for real in Canada, for instance? Because number one, the tests probably cost hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars. If you're testing for what this would be a biohazard, is that correct? Coronavirus itself, would that not be a biohazard? And as such, would have to be tested.
They run vast numbers of tests in one machine. I think that's how they keep the cost down.
Right.
Like if you were to run each test through the machine one at a time, it would be very time consuming and very expensive.
Yes.
But if you can put like 100 samples into this machine, and then at the end it produces 100 results in, you know, an hour or so, then that's not so expensive. So I think lab techs do what they're told. They have a protocol and they follow the protocol, and the answer comes out positive or negative, and that's what they record. Mm-hmm. They have no idea what's really going on in the machine.
Who in Canada, these are questions that are never asked. Who in Canada is doing the tests? Like, when I go for a blood test, it's with a large chain, usually Life Labs in Canada's pretty big. Who is doing these tests? Where are these tests being done? Who are these people doing the tests? Who are these scientists? I'm skeptical that anything is being done at all.
Well, I mean, there's government laboratories, and a lot of people have PCR machines these days.
Okay.
So I think there's lots of places they could send them. I mean, maybe a more important question is, like, are all the tests in Canada using the same?
Yes. Are they synchronized?
PCR cycles.
Yeah. Are they synchronized?
Are they all looking for the same genes?
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I was going to say is that often they'll take multiple samples. You know, maybe they'll take a nose and a throat swab. And if one of them is positive, you're considered infectious.
Right.
Infected,
and yeah.
In a early paper from China, they did up to 18 samples, and in most cases, the majority were negative. But they would take any one positive sample as you're infected.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time they ran 18 was there was a woman that they really, really wanted to be positive. Infected, and they ran 18 samples. They were all negative, and they wrote that although all her PCR tests were negative, due to the epidemiological connections, we consider this woman to be infected.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, they just completely faked it, and they were quite open about it. I think that what you read for statistics is very misleading, because you may have probable cases. You may assume that if one person in a nursing home tests positive, then everybody's infected. So we can't really trust the numbers that they produce. And, you know, I think now the vast majority of cases that are being uncovered are completely asymptomatic people. And don't ask me why people are lining up to get a COVID test.
Because people are afraid. So, David, I know you're not a fakeologist like I am. I know, well, I don't know for sure what you think of my site and what I do. But if this is just the common cold, what is your big picture takeaway? What is happening? What do you think the big picture is? Forget the tests and all the details about what's going on with... What do you think the big picture is? What is the takeaway from someone who believes, who has a website called theinfectiousmyth.com, where you think infections, transmissibility is a myth? What is happening on a worldwide basis?
Yeah. So this is kind of my theory. I think being a public health official is normally very boring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an outbreak of like 3 cases of syphilis. Mm-hmm. Amongst the gay community, and everybody gets really excited, but really it's like 3 cases and nobody died. And, you know, is this really what you want to spend your life on? But they've been propagandized that they're big heroes waiting for the big moment.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been this theory going around that if you can only encircle a new infection and throw everything you have at it, you know, like as a metaphor, the You're going to bomb it. You're going to shoot it. You're going to use flamethrowers. You're going to use rockets. You got everything you're going to have. You're going to point it at this little outbreak, and you're going to utterly destroy the outbreak, and you're going to be a big hero. Now, this did not work out in this case. They did everything they could in Wuhan, and it spread to the world anyway. Well, why did it spread to the world? Well, because nobody can conceive of the issue of a false positive. I mean, the first cases in Italy, for example, were obvious false positives. They were people with no connection to other cases. They hadn't traveled. They hadn't been around foreigners. There was no reason to think that these people were infected. But they considered them all infected, and it never crossed the mind of these public health officials that maybe they were, they're testing in an area that's never been tested before. If you tested 10 years ago in Italy, would you have found, a percentage of people, especially sick people, mm-hmm. who were positive? You may very well have. There's no proof that a year ago you wouldn't find this.
Okay, so who's driving this agenda? David, this is a worldwide event. This is not in one country or the other. This is a coordinated worldwide attack.
Well, their education is coordinated.
So what do you think? Who is behind this? Who has this level of coordination?
Why do doctors have the same treatments for the same disease throughout the entire world? Well, they're all educated in an increasingly narrow education, right? Mm-hmm. That the books used in China are derived from the books used in the United States. And, mm-hmm. If you got this virus, this is the drug that you use. If you have this cancer, here's the, here's the chemo that you use. It's a highly hierarchical environment. And I think we've reached the point where the entire world of medicine is a single hierarchy. Uh-huh. Like I think 100 years ago, there was like a German hierarchy, and there was a British hierarchy, and there was a Chinese hierarchy, and there was an American hierarchy. But they've gradually all morphed into a single hierarchy, and they're interconnected with emails and social networks and all these other things, so that the infection, if it is this information that's going around. Right. It's like this guy in China, Dr. Li, who ended up dying.
Mm-hmm. You think that was a real doctor?
Well, yeah, he was an ophthalmologist. Ophthalmologist who observed seven people in isolation in his hospital. Mm-hmm. That may be an abnormally high number.
And how old was he? Was he 33?
Well, I don't know. I'm just going to accept at face value that he was a 33-year-old ophthalmologist who had no knowledge about
Li Wenliang.
Yes. No knowledge of this domain. And he saw what he thought was a little bit unusual, and he wrote about it. And I don't think he intended to make it a big deal, but it leaked out to the West. And then I think this is where this dynamic between the West and the East happened. The West said, oh my God, are they eating weird stuff in China again? Like bats, pangolins, whatever. And so there was credibility to the emergence of a virus from animals, because Chinese people eat weird stuff, according to the West. Now, I've talked to some Chinese people, and nobody ever heard of anybody eating bats, but, I'm sure it's happened. Probably people have eaten bats in the West.
By the way, he was 33.
Yeah, a bunch of drunk teenagers sitting around, catch a bat and dare each other to eat the bat. I'm sure it's happened, right, in the West. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and in the East, in China, the Chinese government was embarrassed, and they had a financial reason to be embarrassed. They want to produce drugs and vaccines for the West. They're not going to be able to do that if the West doesn't trust them. So they basically went to the WHO and said, what the hell do we do? And the WHO said, lock down the entire city, lock everybody up in their apartment buildings, use the most stringent mechanisms you can. And they did it, and it didn't work. I mean, they found cases all over China, probably false positives. They pretty much turned Wuhan into a prison. And nobody asks any questions. Like there was one guy, this is sort of funny in a black way.
Yeah.
In a city called Hefei, which is, you know, kind of in the middle of nowhere. It's east of Wuhan, I think, and west of Nanjing and Shanghai. And, this 68-year-old man, you know, has a minor symptoms, like probably fever and cough, goes to the hospital, tests positive, keep him in the hospital. His cough and fever resolve. He tests negative twice and they let him go. A few days later, he tests positive again. They drag him back to the hospital. Now he's perfectly healthy, but they give him antiviral drugs anyway. A few days later, he seems to be, he was never sick. So a few days later, they test him again four times. He's negative all four times. They let him go. A few days later, he tests positive again. They drag him back to the hospital again, give him more antiviral drugs. And after a few more days, he tests negative, probably four or five times. And they let him go back into quarantine, but they could keep doing this forever. But at no point in the article that described this did they say, you know, it's possible that we were dealing with false positives for unknown reasons after the guy left the hospital. Even if they believe everything else, there was no questioning of the test, of the accuracy of the test. And people came up with these convoluted arguments like, well, there's still a little bit of the virus maybe dead in his body. But if that was the case, how did he test negative four times? And you have a test that can't distinguish between active virus and dead virus. Like, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just the fact that it's sort of randomly testing positive. And also in China and other places, they found like 10 to 15% of people after being released would test positive once again. And they found that in other countries too. I think in South Korea, they looked at it. And in South Korea, they said, oh, this is just bits and pieces of the virus floating around. But I mean, these tests, PCR tests, can find, I think Buston said, a minimum, you need a minimum of 5 RNA molecules in order for the test to trigger. That's all in a sample. So they're ultra sensitive tests.
Yeah.
So how do you miss, four times? You test a guy and he's negative all four times. And then you say, well, there was some virus in his body, dead virus, but we just didn't catch it. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah. It's a lot of nonsense. Well, I want to ask you some quick questions because we only have another 25 minutes left. What's your take on vaccinations and vaccines? Do you think they are effective? Do you believe in them? Do you take them?
I haven't had a vaccine. I had to have a yellow fever vaccine years ago to go to Nigeria. At least I thought I did. Apparently I didn't really need to, but I did anyway. And it caused, you know, muscle pain.
Sick? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Muscle pain for about a year. I was going to weights and every time I lifted weights, I could feel it, but gradually after a year it went away. So
well, that's a long time.
Relatively minor side effect, but I don't believe in viruses. So why would I believe in vaccines? I think in this case, there clearly is a desire to delay things until the vaccine is out. But, you know, this is kind of wishful thinking because, you know, what if they delayed things with HIV until there was a vaccine? Well, that was 1984 and there's still no vaccine.
Right.
Just because they say they're going to have a vaccine by September, it doesn't mean that they are. And I think now more and more of these biomedical things are scams.
Yeah.
Like this, I forget what the name of this company is where the executives sold their stock, you know, just before the bad results came out. And that to me seems like a financial scam.
Yeah.
So you follow these companies, they give you all these beautiful reports. Things are going well. Animal studies are good. Human studies are going well. And then, you know, you realize it's all fake.
Yeah. I agree.
And even companies that are, say, more reputable, like the big drug companies that aren't probably going to, like, absolutely fake a vaccine, you know, they're not above hiding side effects, changing the standards for the,
Well, who's there to hold them to account? There's no, the regulator, they're integrated tightly. So who's going to hold them to account? So would you get your, if you had or have grandchildren, would you advise your children to have them, your grandchildren vaccinated from
birth. No, I would advise against it.
So you would have, okay. You would advise.
Yeah, I mean, there's too many cases of autism or whatever. Right. I don't really like the word autism because it's so vague.
Right.
And people say vaccines don't cause autism, and it's like it's an argument you can never win because, you know, for some people, autism is almost like a blessing. A child who's sort of more focused than everybody else and is actually smarter.
And keeps some people, quiet without the television.
Right. But on the other hand, there's like 30-year-old children, because they're still really children who are in diapers, and they're violent. And they're like fully physically grown adults. They're obviously in pain.
That's terrible.
They're, you know, they're banging their head against the wall, that kind of stuff. I mean, that is horrifying.
Yeah.
And I really feel for those parents who are going.
Have you ever
that.
Heard of an alternative medicine guy named Agnes von der Planitz?
No.
He's since died, but he was. I've been listening to some old audios from the 2000s with a gentleman named Marcus Allen, who's a really good truth exposer, and he had him on. And apparently, Anonjus has quite a few audios. There's still a website being maintained by somebody. I think it's called, I can't remember what it is called right this second. You might look into it, but he has a great audio that's on my website, fakeologist.com, and I also put it on my other website called fakeotube.com, fakeotube.com. Here's a great audio clip I want to play for you.
So the way I usually wake people up about that is I say, you've got about 68 inert things in it, and five main compounds that go along with the so-called disease. It's either grown, most often it's grown on eggs, so they let the eggs rot and they contaminate them with this, you know, with tissue, diseased tissue of that animal. And then, of course, the bacteria and everything is supposed to grow in the solution, and they put a tiny amount of that, I mean a fraction amount of that, into the vaccine. But what else is in there? They say inert material. What is that inert material? If it's 63 chemicals, what is it? They can't be helpful. No chemical is helpful in the body. And then the main ingredients are liquid mercury, liquid aluminum, formaldehyde, ether, and detergent. Now, if I put that into a blender with some rotten eggs and some diseased animal tissue and offered it to you to drink, would you drink it? Mm-hmm. When I tell people that, they step back and say, oh, gosh, no, I wouldn't drink that.
Great question. Would you take a vaccine intravenously?
Well,
I thought that was a great way of describing it. Go ahead.
He's got it right. I think a lot of vaccine critics go wrong by focusing on the biological ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's less of that, but I think the damage of vaccines often does come from the mercury, which is often still at trace levels, even in, say, so-called mercury-free vaccines, and aluminum, which I don't believe it's really liquid aluminum. It's these weird compounds that are getting more and more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's really weird that aluminum is kind of a biologically inert substance. Just like fluoride, there are no helpful biological substances that contain aluminum or mercury or fluorine. But you can make biologically active substances with those elements.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they're doing with aluminum. But that doesn't mean that it's good for you. And aluminum is a metal. And if it gets into your brain, it can cause severe damage, even at low quantities. And I think that's where we're getting, you know, some of the autism. Yeah. And, you know, mercury is no surprise. You know, if you've read Alice in Wonderland, the Mad Hatter, Hatters use a lot of mercury, and that's why they went mad.
That's right.
These things are neurologically incredibly toxic.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the main. Here's a great little clip I clipped from Anjus when asked, should you take a vaccine?
I'd say never let anybody stick anything into you, ever.
Great quote. And his website, in case you want to look at it, because you're looking at alternative ideas, is called wewanttolive.com. We want the number 2, live.com. And that's still maintained. you should dig up some of his audios. I'll send you links. You can come to my website and take a look. I'll send you some links here on the Discord as well. I have no idea. I can't vouch for him, but what he says, the way he talks, and the alternative ways of looking at things, I think are fantastic, and he would clearly be having a field day right now if he was still alive. But he also shunned all conventional medical treatment, and that may have resulted in his death from whatever happened to him. I'm not quite sure. It's very it's very spooky what happened to him at the end, so I can't really comment.
I'm in a situation where I need some mainstream medical treatments, but I'm kind of lucky in that the mainstream doctors have said they don't want to do surgery or radiation and
no slash burn or poison.
The chemotherapy they are offering me, they agree, is not going to cure anything. Mm. It's almost like it's a placebo to keep me happy, you know, because people say, well, doc, you got to do something. And they say, okay, well, we can give you this chemo. This is state of the art.
Well, you're an advanced patient in the sense that you really know a lot, probably more than your doctor in so many ways. So you probably aren't just grasping at whatever they're going to throw at you because you have
no,
a lot of knowledge.
I'm very skeptical.
You're a sophisticated patient. They probably are a little reticent to treat you just because they know you know more than they do, probably. So it's probably a real paradox for them.
It's surprising. Like, they could easily Google my name, but I'm sure none of them ever would.
Well, just you talking and interacting with them would probably tell them who
they try to baby talk, right? And he was talking about this drug. I said, do you mean it's a nucleoside analog?
You probably blew him away. So, hey.
He said, yes. And, I know a little bit about nucleoside analogs because of AIDS, where they're used extensively. And remdesivir in coronavirus is a nucleoside analog. Mm. And I was going to say earlier that what the drug company did with remdesivir, Gilead, is that they changed the standard for success in the trial. Standard for success to start with was kind of an 8-level scale where, you know, 1 is you're perfectly healthy and 8 is you're dead. And so they kind of rate you on the scale. And that's not an unreasonable way to measure the success of a drug.
Yeah.
I think another level was, are you intubated? Are you on oxygen? You know, they had different levels. But they took that out and they replaced it by, how quickly you're released from the hospital. But if you died, you're not counted, right?
Right.
So deaths were eliminated from the endpoint of the trial. And I actually found, somebody pointed this out, and I went to the U.S. clinical trials database, and they show you all the changes. And here's this day where they took out the 8-level scale, and they replaced it by time to leave the hospital. Now, I think the 8-level scale was continued as a secondary measure. But that allows them to say, our primary measure of success, we had a 10% reduction in time in hospital. But that's only for people who survived.
Yeah.
So it's a completely bogus number. And that's, that is sort of classic, drug company behavior. They don't overtly fake it, right? Not like that company that was producing tests. Run by that rather attractive woman, attractive in how she looked and how she spoke and everything. And it turned out to be a complete fake. That the only test they had working is when they put somebody else's test inside one of their boxes and rigged it up so it would do the tests. They had no technology. That was an utter fake.
Yeah.
But I think the drug companies are a little smarter. They have a drug and they just manipulate the procedure so that it gets success and gets approved.
Now, getting back to your condition and how we can possibly help others by listening to this broadcast, this year I, for the first time, took the FIT test, which is the fecal immuno-something or other test. Did you ever do that? Is that going on in Alberta right now?
No,
Over 50 do that? Because your cancer is the absolute most treatable cancer, most widespread treatable cancer there is, at least in Canada.
I have to admit that it's possible that if 5 years ago I'd been tested for colon cancer, they might have found a small tumor, and it might have been a completely different, completely different thing. Of course, if I had accepted tests for prostate cancer and cholesterol and blood pressure and stuff like that, and followed their advice, I probably will also be dead long ago. So,
right? Did you regularly go to, or do you regularly go to a doctor before this?
No, I never went to a doctor because checkups didn't seem, and I think because I was very fit, I didn't really notice the symptoms for a while, right? Like if I'd gone to a doctor with the first symptoms, they might have found it. Like I've got to admit that doctors have good diagnostic procedures.
Yeah. So would you recommend men over 50 get a fit test then? Would you say that that's not something to be afraid of? You should do it?
Well, yeah, I guess I'd have to say, you know, going to the doctor once in a while, as long as you
I'm just saying
charge.
The fit test specifically, the fecal immunochemical
test. I don't know anything specifically about it, but I know there's a fecal test that they can do to try to detect, you know, colon cancer. Stuff like that is probably worth doing, right?
Okay. Like it might I'm happy to report my test finally came back and I was clean as a whistle, even though it took over 4 months to get it back and it got lost in the mail and all that. So I recommend it. I think it doesn't mean you have to do anything with the results, but sometimes, not every time, I think it's better to know. Another thing that I was going to ask you, and since we're talking about GI stuff, is have you ever heard of the squatting method for going number two? Because I did an interview a couple years ago, and I came upon this based on what's called the squatty potty, which is the little stool you put in front of your toilet, and then I looked into it and found that if you squat when you eliminate number two, you have a much better chance of clear and clean elimination by eliminating the kink in your colon. And this could be just one more thing that could contribute to our poor health, perhaps, in our intestinal system. So are you familiar with squatting to go number two?
Well, I just found out about it after, I was talking to a doctor who said, if you have trouble, because I'd been having trouble with bowel movements.
Right.
It seems less now because of the edema, everything is more fluid. But he suggested putting a stool, like a little two-step stool you might get at IKEA in front, so your legs are way up high.
That's right.
And then you have the more direct.
You remove the kink in your colon. And you see, if we don't eliminate cleanly every single day, which is the normal frequency for going number two or having a bowel movement, then we do have remnants or lingering waste in our system that can possibly toxify. And because we don't naturally go to the bathroom, we sit on the Queen Victoria throne. That obviously is a little easier on your knees, but that's about it. So we've gone backwards in something so simple that in many Asian countries that don't have the luxury of creating these porcelain thrones where they just dig a hole and squat. So I actually purchased years ago after learning this something called the lily pad, which is the cheap way of squatting in existing Western homes, and it just creates two foot pads that go right at the level of the toilet bowl and you climb up upon them. So hopefully you have some wall or railing to grab onto, unless you're perfectly balanced, and then you learn how to squat. And this is what I do every time. And I'm telling you, I don't know what's going on inside my intestines, but it is the cleanest, fastest elimination you'll ever have. Right. And it's fantastic. And you can build the lily pad yourself if you're handy with wood. They'll sell you the plans for $5, or you can have them build it in Auckland, New Zealand. It took about 2 months to ship because it got caught up in customs. I guess they had no idea what it was. But anyway, that to me is just something that perhaps it's not a conspiracy, but you know, if people understand the mechanics of their own bowels, then maybe that will lead to better health. What do you think of that?
Yeah, no, I think it's probably true. It's not something I've really thought of. I hadn't really had problems, and so I never really gave it much thought.
Yeah.
Until, you know, I don't know, maybe a year ago, I started to gradually have problems. And of course, if it's really, really slow, you kind of think it's going to go away, and mm-hmm. and early this year it got really bad, and
oh dear. But well, there's so many things we do in modern society we just take for granted is the right way to do things, but you know, mm-hmm. maybe it's not, because a toilet certainly isn't found in nature. But
well, it's like eating sugar, right? Like,
yeah, I know.
It's become ingrained in our society. And, you know, we elevate these pastry chefs and
well, you get hooked
ice cream
on it.
Makers and stuff to this high level, but they're selling us.
Well, they say sugar is more addictive than cocaine. Now, I haven't tried cocaine. I sure as hell have tried sugar, and damn, it's hard to get away from. But
well, I'm on the keto diet now, so no sugar, no carbs, and I'm also have eliminated alcohol, which you don't have to in the keto diet. You just need to.
Well, David, I think maybe it was Anonjus who was saying alcohol is fuel that you burn in a vehicle. That's what it should be for. So does it make sense to drink it and have your body try and metabolize it?
We have a special enzyme for ethanol. I'm not sure that modest quantities of ethanol are really a big problem, but I have a damaged liver, so.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But isn't that like, I know you say we have an enzyme, but isn't it like drinking a little bit of gasoline? Because it is a fuel. It's flammable. How the hell can it be good for us? I know we're socialized to think that alcohol is okay, but maybe it is just as toxic as drinking gasoline. I know they're closely related in the chemical family, so maybe that socialization is totally wrong.
I think ethanol has been in our diet for years. I mean, mm-hmm. If you don't have refrigeration, a lot of food starts to produce ethanol.
Mm-hmm. But in the quantity that you drink in a bottle of scotch?
Well,
or
I agree.
A glass of scotch.
Day, then yeah. you know, you got a problem. So I'm not convinced. And I think if I was ever to be clear of liver cancer and, you know, my rectal tumor resolves, then I might go back to drink a small amount, like a glass of red wine a week, something like that.
I understand. You got to enjoy life, but I just think these are things to consider. One more thing I wanted to bounce off you, and that is chlorine. We are all told that fluoride is probably toxic and not good to drink. What do you think of the idea that heart disease or inflammation in and around the arteries that supply the heart, the inflammation might be caused by drinking water or the chlorine in drinking water? Because most people don't reverse osmosis like I do their water to purify it before they drink it. They drink it mostly out of the tap, and it is chlorinated. Obviously, it has to be chlorinated to get to your tap. But what do you think of the idea that chlorine is actually toxic to humans to drink in just about any quantity, and perhaps that, more than fat or sugar or any of the other things we're told, might be more toxic than we're told? Anything?
I haven't looked into that.
Because obviously chlorine and fluoride are in the same chemical group. They have the same... Mm-hmm. The same ionization rate, and we all know that chlorine is toxic. I mean, chlorine.
Yeah.
I swim in my public pool when it used to be open. You know, if you don't get that chlorine off your skin, which is the largest organ on your body, that thing dries it out. I don't know if it's toxic enough to make you feel bad, but it's definitely, if it kills bacteria on contact, which is of course what we want, because we don't want cholera from drinking water or swimming in high bacterial count water, then how good is it to ingest in any quantity?
There are some pools that use salt water, and then they
reduce
when
the
they
chlorine.
Suck the water. Well, no, what happens is when they suck the water in, they break the salt into sodium and chloride.
Mm-hmm.
Chloride kills the bacteria as it's going through the cleaning process.
Mm-hmm.
And then they let it rejoin, and now you have salt again.
Mm-hmm. But there is
and
still,
like
there's still, there. I think it only allows you to reduce the chlorine. There's still chlorine put into the saltwater pools, I believe. So have you ever heard that chlorine might be toxic to us? Is that
I have, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I just can't investigate everything.
No, I know you can't, but, you know, if people get heart disease and it's the number one cause of death in North America, maybe there's more to it than just meats and fats and sugars. everyone drinks water. So maybe if it is the number one cause of death, maybe there's a wider thing going on in our lives that's toxic. So, you know, these are the things that no one is going to look into, because that would be a big problem, I guess, if they had to give everyone a reverse osmosis filter, even though you can buy one for $200. I don't know why people wouldn't just automatically buy it and put it in and not drink chlorinated water.
Yes.
All right. Well, David, we've come up to about an hour, and before we go and I ask you to give us some final words, I want to wish you the best in your battle. I think it's awful. I really feel badly for you, because I think you're a very good voice when it comes to discussing alternative medicine. I think you do a great show. I listen to it all the time. I'm one of your Patreons. Everyone should support alternative media. Everyone should also support David, because now he's in a fight for his life, which is really depressing, but hopefully we can pass you good wishes and good thoughts through the microphone, through the airwaves. So do you have
the number of positive messages I've received has been really touching and heartwarming. And of course, everybody has a different thing that I have to do to get over the cancer, and I've taken what I think is going to work for me. I'm covering my own cancer in my own podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I've done two episodes already. This week is going to be a different topic, but I'll get back to it, and I'll see how long I can keep. And you know, it's a real time struggle, and you know, the end might be an announcement that Dave is not here anymore. Or it might be that, you know, things have turned around, the liver tumors have shrunk, and that, you know, I don't want to talk about my cancer anymore because it's largely behind me.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to go back to, you know, addressing with energy some of the other topics. But, you know, right now I don't know which way it's going to go. I'm not in a terribly good place health-wise, but I'm still working, and I'm trying to use willpower to do what I can't accomplish physically, right? Like it's to get out of the house to go for a walk takes a lot of willpower, and I want to keep doing that.
Well, I hope you are able to recover, and I think your mental health is just as important as the pharmaceutical and the physical medical help. I think your attitude is important. I think just being free of stress. Like, one of the great things about being a fakeologist is I'm not worried that people are trying to kill us. I'm not worried about a killer virus. I'm not worried about nuclear weapons. And I'm really not worried about most of the things that they try and scare the hell out of us to do, to manipulate us and to control us. So I'm free of the cortisol that's probably coursing through most people in the world's veins right now. I'm free and I feel good. And again, your mental health probably will serve you better than any drug. So if you can just think positively, even though it sort of sounds like sort of a BS way of dealing with things, I think it can go a long way to extending your life and your health. And I definitely wish you all the best. And I'm sure all the Fakeologist listeners wish you the best as well.
Thank you so much.
All right. It was fantastic talking with you. Get some rest, take it easy, and just, and keep doing the great work that you're doing, because you're one of the,
I want to get back.
You are the only voice in your field, in a way, just breaking up the health myth. And I think it's been fantastic.
Thanks.
You've helped me a lot.
Okay. Great.
All right. Okay, David, thank you very much, and we'll disconnect and finish off the podcast. So thanks, everyone, for listening. David Crow, theinfectiousmyth.com. Support him at the same name on Patreon. All right, good night.
Hey, I've had quite a few questions over the last few weeks, so I'm making this for my friends to clear a few things up. First and foremost, something you should know, you cannot catch a virus. And why can't you catch a virus? Because it's impossible. So why is it impossible to catch a virus?
Question.
A virus is alive. Is a virus a living thing?
No, no, no.
So how is it that people think that you can catch something that is not alive?
Everybody knows you never go full retard.
Now, I know a lot of people are genuinely concerned, so that's why I'm making this, to hopefully cure some of the unnecessary fear and stress. And if you are feeling that, it's because you're causing it for yourself. And just so you don't think I'm sitting here making stuff up, I'll quickly tell you my background so you know how and why I'm telling you these things. I was one of those kids that could read and write before I even started school. I knew my 1 to 12 times table before other kids even knew how to open a book. I won academic scholarships at 2 expensive private schools. I did 6 years of science, which